The Vintage Gamer, Episode 26, Sherlock Holmes, Consulting Detective.
This show is a member of Goblin, the gaming broadcast network, gbncom.com.
Hello, and welcome to The Vintage Gamer, the podcast that seeks out great games from an earlier era. I'm your host, Jim Van Verth. As always, this show is available via RSS or direct download at www.thevintagegamer.net. Well, the big news this episode is that I'm officially vintage now. Yes, I turned 40 a couple of weeks ago and celebrated in proper Vintage Gamer style by throwing a mini-con, GymCon 2006. My wife, Murr, made up some really nifty badges, and we had a whole lot of people over, including some Vintage Gamer listeners, John and Laura, who traveled all the way from the Baltimore area, and Rich Siegfried of the Requiem of the Outcast and Mr. Adventure podcast. Got to play a bunch of games. Got to play Tigris and Euphrates, which is actually my favorite game, Cosmic Encounter, Robo Rally, and wrap things up with a marathon game of Apples to Apples. And I actually got to play a little Arkham Horror before that, before I switched over to Tigris and Euphrates. And my good friend Jason Adams of the Random Signal podcast got together with his wife and some other friends and gave me a copy of Guitar Hero, which I've been playing heavily. In fact, so much that we actually went out and bought Guitar Hero 2 just so we could have the second guitar controller. We'll probably be doing that a lot, at least until the Wii shows up on Christmas Day. But don't tell our daughter. Beyond that, it's been fairly quiet here in Vintage Gamer headquarters, other than working on the usual Christmas celebrations with our daughter and being, well, outrageously sick. As far as the first part, last weekend we managed to get the decorations and lights up, participate in a Christmas pageant, and then go see the Nutcracker. And needless to say, we were a bit cranky. Not as cranky as yesterday, when all of us came down with the stomach bug that's been going around. Yuck. But going back to winter holidays and more pleasant things, I want to wish a happy Hanukkah to any Jewish listeners out there. As I record this, the Feast of Lights is in progress and probably will be finishing up when I finally upload. I do hope that the Spirits of the Maccabees brought you a game for every night, and I don't mean a dreidel. I mean, if you're going to do that, you might as well play LCR. Of course, you don't get the guild if you play LCR. Anyway, one final note, both copies of Politica that I offered up at the end of the last podcast are gone. One of the speedsters who got one is Mark Kinney of All Games Considered. Unfortunately, I lost the email for the other person. Stupid Gmail deletes things by thread. So if you're not Mark Kinney, and I told you that you are getting a copy of Politica, please contact me again. As an identifier, let me know what game you wanted to trade for it. By the way, I'm not expecting people to trade games for this. It was just this person offered this. However, I do have some good news for those who didn't get in early. Even though all of my copies are gone, I did manage to get one and maybe two additional copies from people at work. So instead of just saying first come, first serve for those, since I already have a list of names, I'm just going to do a drawing. If you haven't already contacted me and you want in on that, January 1st, I'm going to do a drawing for those and tell you the results after that. Well, that's about it here. I will be back with my review of Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective right after this.
This is Don.
And Derek.
And Jeremiah.
From Pulp Gamer, the paper game pod show.
Christmas is fast approaching, and we want to make sure you're prepared for a shopping season by giving you a list of some ideas you may have overlooked. Games.
We're not talking about the brain-sucking console or computer games. We're talking about good old-fashioned spend time with friends and family board games.
Something to stimulate young minds and mature minds, even immature minds.
The board game industry's come a long way since the classics that are probably still in your game closet.
Let us share these ideas with you on our special Christmas shopping episode of Out of Character, available at pulpgamer.com.
Have a happy and safe holiday season.
In my youth, or in my youth, as Joe Pesci would say, I read a lot of mysteries. John D. MacDonald, Ross McDonald, G.K. Chesterton, Agatha Christie, Lawrence Block. There was a period in my life where I just sucked them all down. But my favorite of all was Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. Part of that is probably because my dad liked them so much, and I like my dad. I remember one special time when he took me to see a re-release of the classic film Hound of the Baskervilles. For some reason, it was showing at a local movie theater. And in reading the books, I also liked the interplay between Holmes and Watson and the Victorian atmosphere, the fog-laden streets, the horse-drawn carriages, the gas lamps. But there was one aspect to Sherlock Holmes that drove me nuts. Conan Doyle didn't play fair with the audience. Holmes always had access to information that the reader did not. He could read an article in the newspaper and dash off, leaving Watson and the reader in bewilderment. He could read the character off of a person from their clothing and mannerisms, but sometimes those weren't described for the reader, so those clues weren't available. Until, of course, the end, when Holmes revealed all. He could find a bit of material at a scene, go back to the lab and analyze it, and only reveal it, again, when the criminal is caught. These stories were set up to make Holmes look smart, and in the process, make the reader feel dumb, or at least frustrated. Now, there are exceptions, of course. The clue of the dancing men is available to anyone who knows cryptography, and the key bit of information in Silver Blaze is made quite clear to the reader. But generally, trying to solve the mystery yourself is impossible. There's just not enough information there. In 1981, a company called Sleuth Publications released a game that solved that problem. Designed by Gary Grady, Suzanne Goldberg, and Raymond Edwards, it was called Sherlock Holmes, Consulting Detective. In this game, you are given 10 cases to solve along with Holmes. Each case begins with an opening chapter, written in the style of Conan Doyle, or perhaps a bit more flippantly, but generally close. Then you travel across London, collecting clues, and eventually solving the crime. In the end, you need to answer a set of questions, which are not revealed until the end, tally up points based on your answers, and then compare your score to Holmes. But, unlike the books, you have access to all the same information Holmes does. The key is that you have to choose which locations are the important ones to visit, and then put the pieces together yourself. And that, in a nutshell, is the game. But it's really the amount of detail that makes the game compelling. The original game comes with three small books, created with clip art and typed up on a typewriter. Those books are the rule book, the book of cases, and a quiz book. And this last one has the questions and solutions in it. Despite the low production values, those alone contain a fair amount of atmosphere, just in the way the language inside is presented. But along with that, you get a large map of Victorian London, which is really cool. It's broken into five regions, northwest, southwest, west central, etc. And within each region are 100 or so separate locations where you can go to look for clues to the current case. Together with the map, there is a London directory indicating the people you can find at those locations. So, if you want to find the victim's brother, for example, you can look him up here to find out where he might be. The clues themselves are in a larger book. Now, for each case, there is a list of locations related to that case, and a paragraph, or sometimes more, consisting of an interview that Holmes has with a person at that location. In theory, you could go to all the locations for that case and get a great deal out of the experience. You get the full picture of what is going on in London at that time that may or may not be related to the case. But to maximize your score, you want to visit as few locations as possible, which I'll explain in a moment. Finally, there is a newspaper archive which you can read at any time. Just like the clues, some of the articles in the archive relate to the cases, and some are red herrings, and some just add flavor, like advertisements and things like that. However, you can only read the articles that match the date of the current case or are older. Now, this makes sense. There's no peeking ahead to the future. As a final note on the components, there are two versions of the original game. There's a box set and what is generally considered the nicer one, which is a binder version. The box set is basically all the stuff is loose in a box, kind of like the old D&D used to be. But the latter one, the binder one, is stored in a three-ring binder with a leatherette cover with a big picture of Sherlock Holmes on it. And most of the material is stuck in pockets. And what's clipped inside the binder is the clue book. Now, I have this version, and honestly, I'm not 100% sure, or convinced at least, that it's the nicer one. It may be just because I have bad luck with vinyl and photocopied material. I think there's some sort of chemical reaction which causes the ink on the photocopies to either stick on the vinyl or to other paper inside. And because of this, lots of games that I have that have vinyl, well, they have these big marks on them. So, for example, my roll-up Pente board, which is a vinyl board, has a big mark on it from the rules. At one point, Red Storm gave us all these nice binders, you know, kind of folder things with vinyl covers, and it now has a big photocopy smudge on it because I put a copy on top of it. And, of course, various books, as well as the notebook cover in my copy of Consulting Detective, has bits of text all over them from a single sticky sheet of paper, which is basically an errata, and almost useless, pretty much, because I can just look and find all the stuff myself. Now, perhaps the vinyl had nothing to do with it. Maybe other people have better luck with that. Now, there are four different modes in which you can play Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective. The first is a solitaire game where you alone are going up against Holmes. Gameplay is pretty simple. First, you pick a case and read the initial description. Then you look at the map, pick a location to go to, open up the clue book, find that location listed under your case, and then read the clue that you found there. You have to jot down that you visited that location, because remember, the number of locations you go to will affect your score. You want to also jot down any notes that you care to, and then you pick another location to visit, find it in the clue book, and so proceed. Now, as I said, each place you visit counts as a point against you that will be compared to Holmes. And because of that, you can't go back and peek at a location you've been to. It will count as another trip. So if you didn't take good notes, well, you're out of luck. You repeat this process of finding clues until you think you know the answer to the mystery. Then you open up the quiz book and answer the questions you find there under your particular case. And each correct answer gives you a certain number of points. To that, you add the difference between the number of locations it took you to solve the mystery and the number of locations the quiz book tells you it took Holmes to solve the mystery, multiplied by 5. Now, this will likely be a negative number because Holmes is very efficient in traveling around and finding clues. For example, in the first case, it only takes him 4 clues. And Holmes also, of course, gets all of the quiz answers correct. So in general, the best you can ever do is to match Holmes. Well, unless, of course, you manage to solve the mystery in fewer locations than he does. In which case, I'd probably have to say you're a good guesser. Now, note that despite being described as a board game, this really is not a board game. This is a paragraph-based game boiled down to its essence, words. Unlike a board game, you don't place a piece on the map indicating your current location, nor do you have any time or distance restrictions on your movement. There is a time of travel gauge on the map, but that's so you can verify people's stories or rule them out as suspects. So, for example, if you can confirm that someone is in one location at 5 p.m., and the murder occurred at 5:30 p.m., and it would take that person more than half an hour to get to the murder location, well, they have a solid alibi. Assuming you can trust your source. Now, two-player is pretty much the same, except that you're both playing against each other and Holmes. Each player alternates looking at the clue book and reading clues. However, they don't reveal them to each other. So those clues are kept secret to each player. And when a player thinks they have the answer, they may stop and complete the quiz while the other player continues, going and looking up clues. And at the end, points are totaled up as before, and the winning player is the one with the highest score. with more than two players, again, each player goes around in turn and visits locations and reads clues. However, in this case, the clues are read out loud. Also, you can play in, just like the two-player, in adversarial mode, where each person is competing against each other, or you can play cooperatively, where everyone is working together to solve the case before Holmes. Now, when playing cooperatively, each location visited is counted as a point against the group, rather than the individual who goes there. In the adversarial case, you still get to hear the other player's clues, but the point only counts against the player who visited it. Otherwise, as the two-player version, the gameplay is pretty much identical to the solitaire, as is the scoring. Now, having described this, it's a little unclear to me why the adversarial version is the way it is. It seems to me that reading all the clues out loud just makes it easier than the other versions. You get to find out information without spending the clue points. I'm guessing it's simply to keep the game moving along and interactive. Otherwise, you'd have a group of people reading silently to themselves until one by one they drop out as they solve the mystery. Also, with a larger group, the game would take a lot longer if everyone had to work alone. If it takes you half an hour to solve a case by yourself, then multiply that by four people, well, you get the idea. Still, it seems likely that you'd be able to beat Holmes by this method if you had enough people. Then again, the mysteries are pretty tough. I think I've played this game once or twice with a large group of people, and we had a pretty tough time beating it. So maybe that advantage isn't enough. Another thing I don't see is why you couldn't play cooperative with two players, why they just had an adversarial version for two players. It should work just as well. The only thing I can think of is that maybe at the time they couldn't see why you'd want to do that. There are plenty of two-player games out there that were pretty much head-to-head. Well, I don't know. Just take those as possible variants proposed by this humble reviewer.
This is James Ernest of Cheap Ass Games, and you're listening to The Vintage Gamer.
Strategy for the game is pretty straightforward. It's a mystery. I mean, you figure out who the suspects are, you determine the important locations, and then you go check your sources. There are some additional people you can talk to. At the beginning of the clue book, there is a lecture by Holmes that provides some additional names to ask questions of, beyond just the names you get from the description in the casebook. And these range from trustworthy solicitors to shady underworld types.
Oi!
Excuse me. Former shady underworld types. Current innkeepers.
Thank you, Governor.
The game plays out just like a mystery would, except that, well, you're the detective. You get to choose where to go, who to talk to, and what you're going to find out. And finally, you get to come up with your own theory of the crime, without having Holmes or Poirot or Ms. Marple or whoever tell you how it turns out. Of course, you might find out that you're wrong. Because of that, and my love of mysteries, I just love this game and how it plays out. I think the gameplay is astonishingly simple. And honestly, it's so blindingly obvious, I'm surprised no one thought of it before. I think once the paragraph-based game became a popular form, back in that early 80s time, a game like this was just simply inevitable. And it's a shame that more games like this aren't created today. But I guess it is a fair amount of work for what is very little return. I mean, considering the fact that Sleuth did go out of business. However, despite my love for this game, it has one major, deep, abiding flaw. Due to its nature, each case is a one-off. Once you solve it, or don't solve it, as the case may be, you really can't play it again, because you already know the answer. So, once you work through those 10 cases, you're done. Now, I suppose you could sort of read it again like you would a good detective novel and follow different paths of investigation. But that experience of discovery will never be the same. Oh, one solution might be to get a brain injury like the character in Memento. Then you could play the game every day and not remember the answer. Or you could play it backwards. But that might be an extreme solution for just one game. A more practical solution would be to get some of the expansions. There are four expansions, each with more cases to solve. The first was the Mansion Murders, released in 1983, which covers a series of murders that take place in a manor house in London. There is, of course, the requisite locked room mystery, and a previously unrevealed chapter in the history of the Maltese Falcon. Clearly, these folks like Dashiell Hammett just as much as Conan Doyle. The Mansion Murders is a standalone game, so you don't actually need a copy of the original to play it. The second expansion, or perhaps sequel is a better name because these are mostly standalone games, is The Queen's Park Affair, released in 1984. Again, as I said, this is mainly a standalone game centered around the Queen's Park area of London. There was sort of an expansion version, which didn't come with the London directory and map, again, assuming that you already had it from the first one. So you want to be careful when shopping for this one online, especially if you don't have the first one. The other problem with this one is that there's actually no solution included with the first edition. The original plan was that players would submit their answers as entries in a contest, and after the contest was over, the solution would be available for those who wanted to send in a dollar. The company now being defunct, those answers are a little hard to come by, so you can either get the second edition, which did come with those solutions, or there is a thread on BoardGameGeek which may help you get them if you need them. In 1989, Sleuth Publications released a third supplement called Adventures by Gaslight. This one did not come in a standalone version, it just added a new casebook, clue book, newspapers, and a map of Paris. I'm presuming that it also came with these solutions. And finally, in 1995, there was West End Adventures. And while this is listed on BoardGameGeek as being published by Sleuth, I believe at this point Sleuth Publications was defunct as a publisher, and the license had actually been purchased by Chessex. The copyright on this says 1990/1995, which implies, at least to me, that the game was first planned to be released right after Adventures by Gaslight, but was instead delayed until 1995. As far as the content of the game, at least one comment on BGG says this one isn't as historically accurate as the first one, but you do get more cases to solve. If that isn't enough, Sleuth Publications did have a couple of games outside of the Holmes genre. In Gumshoe, you get to play a very Dashiell Hammett-like character solving hard-nosed detective cases in the foggy streets of San Francisco. You ever notice how much fog plays a part in the detective novel? Anyway, I'm not sure if the Maltese Falcon makes an appearance here too, but I wouldn't be surprised. Again, if you're going to track this one down, be careful. In the first printing, there are some serious errors that make the first case, well, unsolvable. Some copies come with errata, and some don't. These were corrected in the second printing, so I would recommend getting that if you can. And there was one expansion for Gumshoe called the Chinatown Caper, but this one appears to be quite rare. I found vague references to it, wasn't able to find it online, and doesn't even have an entry on BoardGameGeek. Sleuth also produced an actual board game called Jack the Ripper. Now, I don't know much about this one, but looks to be rather interesting. One player plays Jack, and the other player plays the police commissioner trying to track him down. I'm guessing, based on the board and the general description of the game, it has some similarities to Scotland Yard and Fury of Dracula, but I haven't been able to find out much information about it. Now, going back to Sherlock Holmes, in 1992, Consulting Detective was turned into a PC multimedia game, taking three of the cases from the original. You take on the role of Wiggins, who's a member of the Baker Street Irregulars, as opposed to kind of the unnamed character from the original game. And as with the original, there is a setup with Holmes and Watson, which in this case is in full motion video. And then you can search the newspaper archives or visit contacts and investigate clues, much of which are also filmed. As a PC game, it was understandably a little clunky with some rather muddy video. I mean, it was 1992 after all. Compression technology has gotten a lot better. And I can't imagine what the Sega port was like. There's actually a Mac port as well, which is probably pretty good. But it has been released as a DVD game, and the video in that has been restored to a standard 4x3 television quality. And based on the reviews that I've read, it appears to work quite well as a DVD game. Now, one advantage that this version has, beyond just, you know, you actually get to see the characters on the screen, is that if you guess wrong, you don't actually end up finding out what the answers are. Instead, you're sent back to gather more clues until you can figure it out. And that's something I'm not really sure how you can make it work in the paper version. One possibility, which is tempting to do, is just to ask someone else to verify whether I got it wrong or right. So I write down my answers, give it to somebody else. Did I get it? Nope. Okay, I get to keep looking. It's a possibility, and it might actually improve the longevity of the game. Of course, then you would know what the questions are, which might affect how your investigation goes, but it's a possibility. In any case, you can easily get the DVD game online. I'll have a link to the site in the show notes. Or if you really want to, you can track down copies of the PC or Mac games. Probably wouldn't recommend tracking down the Sega game. If you're going to play it on your TV, you might as well get the DVD version. So, in conclusion, Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective is a classic for deduction game and mystery lovers alike. If you like reading mysteries and solving the crime, or you like playing deduction games and are looking for something just a little different, I highly recommend you pick this one up. It does have the replayability issues, so you won't want to spend too much on it, unless, of course, you're a collector. But there are copies available on eBay and other places at reasonable prices. There are also copies available at unreasonable prices, but I don't recommend you pay those. And you can't have mine. I'll be back with feedback on the Politica episodes right after this.
If you're like me and you can't find nothing good to watch on TV while doing your menial house chores, why don't you do what I do? Listen to Dwayne Harrelson and Villain Talk. You can find his website at home.comcast.net/tildevillaintalk. Villain Talk is all one word. Now I better get back to tenderizing tonight's dinner.
I got a fair amount of feedback on the Politica episodes. One thing I was curious about was whether splitting it up made sense. Well, I got one comment from Kevin, who said it was fine, but he would have preferred it as one long episode. And then I got the counterpoint from Eduardo, who said that he preferred it split up rather than 1 hour long show. So, kind of a mixed message there. I'm thinking it was an interesting experiment, but I've been tracking some stats, and one of my more downloaded shows is actually the Fury of Dracula one, and that one's quite long. So, for now, I think I'll just keep them as one piece until it makes some logical sense, as it kind of did with Politica. Or, unless, of course, it starts approaching that deadly one-hour mark, which I really, really don't want to cross again. There were also a lot of comments about the iTunes issue, and it appears that no one had any trouble getting the show off the feed. And as it turns out, that's because it wasn't the issue. FeedBurner, which is what I use to track my stats mostly, changed how it counts subscribers around the same time that iTunes 7 came out. Before, they were overcounting subscribers, and thus my subscriber count dropped. Mystery solved. But a big thank you to everyone who told me that everything was fine on their end. Overall, the comments on the content were quite positive. Carl wrote, "Thank you, Jim. I believe these two episodes taken together are your best podcast. Before these two episodes, I thought of you as a game geek who seized on a niche topic, older games, which was ideal for making a podcast. Now I think of you as the only game geek I know with the wisdom and experience to do justice to this topic and make it interesting to a wide audience. Both of these episodes gave me several, I've never thought of that before, moments, especially the discussion about playtesting." And actually responded to him via email, and a bit of it goes like this. Said, "Well, thank you. That's high praise. At the risk of playing the doth protest too much card, I will say that I have spent a great deal of time thinking about Politica, which is not time that I've been able to give to other games. But I will keep in mind what you say and try to apply those lessons to future reviews." Another listener, named Jim, not me, wrote, "I really enjoyed the podcast on Politica. It was great to hear about a game from the lead designer's point of view. I'm surprised you did not mention what I have to believe was your game's predecessor, Kremlin, by Avalon Hill." Well, sorry, Jim, this probably hurts my vintage gaming cred, but I've actually never played Kremlin. That was another one of those games that we should have tried before creating Politica, but didn't. I was aware of the game, and I believe that I was afraid of being too influenced by it, which is kind of ironic given the other influences to the game. Now, those two responses were fairly glowing, and unless you think I only play praise here, I got an email from Ken, who starts out by praising the Politica episodes, but also adds, "I noticed in your last show that you mentioned listenership was down in the past month. I have to admit, there was a downturn in my interest as well, beginning with the episode you did as a dialogue with Murr. Nothing against Murr, but the show seems better as a monologue. Following that show, there were several special/non-single-game-format shows, in parentheses, Dragon Con, books, Halloween, etc. I enjoy cons and books, but I don't listen to the Vintage Gamer to hear entirely about cons and books, unless they are mentioned in the context of that show's featured game. I like the one game, one episode theme, a short segment in a game-themed episode, rather than a whole show, would be better in my opinion." And I'm assuming that what he means by a short segment in a game-themed episode would be like, I'd cover a game and then have like a 2 to 3 minute segment talking about a particular book or something like that. I think these are fair comments, and I have to admit that I have been drifting away from the original format a bit of late. I still think there is some place for specialty episodes. For example, I'd like to do some interviews, and I do think there are some games that don't really warrant their own individual show, like they just don't have enough meat to them, but they could be bundled together somehow. Like one show I've been considering is games derived from Monopoly. Well, don't recoil on horror too much. There are actually some good ones out there. But perhaps I have been overdoing it a bit much on drifting away from that original format. Now, because of this, and not just because of this email, but just because I've been thinking it as well, for the next few episodes, I am planning on doing the one game, one show approach. But let me know what you think about Ken's comment there. So, if you have feedback on that, or this show, or the podcast in general, you can send that via email to vintagejim@gmail.com, or you can chat with me on Skype via username jvsquare. Or you can leave comments on the website, which is www.thevintagegamer.net, or you can comment on the forum thread at BoardGameGeek, or RPG.net, or wherever else I may manage to post to. There are so many options, it's mind-boggling, but I will track them all. And thus concludes yet another investigative episode of The Vintage Gamer. Our theme is performed by the trio Music of the Spheres, and available on the album of the same name at Magnatune.com. Your humble host is Jim Van Verth. The Vintage Gamer will return in a couple of weeks with another game from the past. Until then, keep trying those new games, but don't forget to play the old ones. Thanks for listening.